Knowledge Products presents The Giants of Philosophy, Baruch Spinoza, narrated by Charlton Heston. Part 2.
A great part of the difficulty in understanding Spinoza's main work stems from the way he wrote it, the actual structure of his exposition. Upon opening the Ethics, the reader first notices not the revolutionary ideas, but the strange form in which Spinoza writes. First come definitions, then axioms, then a number of propositions, each one followed by a proof. The model for this kind of exposition is Euclid's classical text from the 4th century BC, entitled The Elements of Geometry. Spinoza presents his philosophical views as if he were writing a treatise in mathematics. He called this form of writing the geometrical method of demonstration, and its terse formality has intimidated many a potential reader. One 20th century commentator expressed his frustration this way.
Spinoza's ethics is cast into geometrical form to make the thought Euclideanly clear, but the result is a laconic obscurity in which every line requires a Talmud of commentary.
There are reasons why Spinoza chose this highly formal geometrical method for presenting his ideas, historical as well as philosophical reasons. Considering these reasons can help in understanding Spinoza's concept of God. Spinoza lived in the 17th century, a time imbued with a profound respect for mathematics. Galileo applied mathematics to the study of nature with startlingly successful results. Indeed, in a famous passage, Galileo declared that mathematics is the very language of nature itself.
Philosophy is written in this grand book, the universe, which stands continually open to our gaze. But the book cannot be understood unless one first learns to comprehend the language and read the letters in which it is composed. It is written in the language of mathematics, and its characters are triangles, circles, and other geometric figures, without which it is humanly impossible to understand a single word of it. Without these, one wanders in a dark labyrinth.
Galileo had shown that mathematics, especially geometry, very successfully describes and explains natural phenomena. Indeed, in the 17th century, mathematics seemed in itself to be a perfect example of certain and indubitable knowledge. In Euclidean geometry, for example, everything follows with deductive certainty from the initial premises. Once we understand and accept the definitions and axioms, the truth of the theorem derived from them is beyond doubt. Spinoza believed that any well-ordered system of knowledge could be put into this sort of geometrical order with self-evident axioms and definitions and deductively certain theorems. In fact, the only work that Spinoza published under his own name during his lifetime was an exposition setting Descartes' philosophy into a geometrical order. The preface to that work, written by Spinoza's friend Ludovic Meyer, explains the importance of the geometrical method like this.
Everyone who wishes to be wiser than is common among men agrees that the best and surest method of seeking and teaching the truth in the sciences is that of the mathematicians, who demonstrate their conclusions from definitions, postulates, and axioms. Indeed, this opinion is rightly held. For since a certain and firm knowledge of anything unknown can only be derived from things known certainly beforehand, these things must be laid down at the start as a stable foundation on which to build the whole edifice of human knowledge. Otherwise, it will soon collapse of its own accord or be destroyed by the slightest blow.
It's not surprising, then, that in expounding his own systematic philosophy, Spinoza would choose to employ the geometrical method of demonstration. Though he surely knew that it doesn't make for easy reading, he thought the effort required of the reader would be rewarded by greater clarity and certainty. And there's more to Spinoza's choice of the geometrical method than just his desire for clarity. Historians of philosophy usually classify Spinoza as a rationalist. As a rule, rationalists believe that if we begin with genuinely clear, simple, and self-evidently true ideas, and if we carefully follow out the consequences of those ideas, we can develop a whole system of truths, all accurately reflecting reality. Euclid's geometry provides the classic example of such a project. He began with simple definitions and axioms, and from these he deduced an entire system of geometrical truths. The success of Euclid's project convinced the rationalists that knowledge can be had by following his procedure, by beginning with the simple and self-evident and deductively following out its consequences. If there's any question about the later propositions in Euclid's geometry, we can always trace the proposition back to its grounding in the initial premises. These premises, the definitions, axioms, and postulates, were thought to be so self-evident that they require no further justification. They are self-justifying. Spinoza wants his philosophy to have this kind of complete intelligibility and rational justification at all levels. But the difficulty in constructing a philosophical system of this kind is finding the right starting points, which must be simple and indubitable. Spinoza needs definitions which are intuitively clear and axioms which are self-evidently certain. As a rationalist, Spinoza is committed to a principle called the principle of sufficient reason. According to this principle, there's a reason or a cause for everything that exists and every event that occurs. Spinoza says,
"From a given definite cause, an effect necessarily follows. And on the other hand, if no definite cause be granted, it is impossible that an effect can follow."
Furthermore, everything and every event can be and must be understood by referring to its cause. Axiom 4 of Part 1 of the Ethics addresses this by saying,
"The knowledge of an effect depends upon and involves the knowledge of its cause."
In this statement, Spinoza makes it clear that our understanding of things must reflect the causal order of things. Now, in most cases, things and events are caused and thus explained by other prior things and events. And these prior things are caused and thus explained by still other things yet further back in the chain of causes. If there were no end to this chain of causes and explanations, then we would never arrive at a truly sufficient reason for anything, and there would be no final intelligibility to the world. If reality is to be intelligible, there must be something that needs no cause in order to exist, an explanation that does not require a further explanation. Such a thing, such an explanation, provides a beginning for the chain of causes and explanations, just as Euclid's self-evident definitions and axioms provide a beginning for geometry. This is Spinoza's starting point, something that can exist without a prior cause, an explanatory principle that needs no further explanation. This thing, which has no cause and needs no explanation, obviously provides an appropriate starting point for a systematic philosophy such as Spinoza's. The term he uses to refer to this starting point is substance. Substance is an age-old concept whose meaning has changed somewhat over the centuries, but it's long been at the heart of that branch of philosophy known as metaphysics. The sense in which Spinoza employs the term is similar to that of his predecessor in the 17th century, René Descartes. Descartes defined the term substance this way.
"A substance is a thing that so exists that it needs no other thing in order to exist."
Now, this is clearly the starting point that Spinoza was seeking, something that needs no other thing in order to exist. Substance is something whose existence does not depend upon a prior cause. This is the most basic principle in Spinoza's system, and the first part of the Ethics develops at length the implications of this concept. He begins with a clear grasp of the concept of substance and follows its logic carefully. Ultimately, he finds only one thing can be independent of all else. He says, "Once we recognize that there can be only one such thing, we must also grant that everything else is ultimately caused by and dependent upon that one thing. Indeed, all things in the world are manifestations of the one first cause." Spinoza arrives at this sweeping conclusion by analyzing the very idea of substance. First, he argues that a being which requires nothing else for its existence must be an infinite being. If it were finite, then it would have some limits of some kind, since finite means limited. Any limited substance would have to be limited by some other thing. It couldn't be limited by nothing. But if a substance were limited by another thing, the other thing that limits it would partially determine what the substance is. But then the substance would not be independent of all other things, and hence it would not be a substance as we have defined it. Spinoza therefore concludes,
every substance is necessarily infinite.
So far, Spinoza's been writing as if there may be more than one substance. But in fact, once we've established that any substance must be infinite, it's easy to show that there can be only one such substance.
If someone now asks by what sign we shall be able to distinguish the diversity of substances, let him read the following propositions, which show that in nature there exists only one substance, and that it is absolutely infinite. So, a sign would be sought in vain.
It follows, then, from the infinity of substance there can be only one. If there were a second, separate and distinct from the first, then that second substance, being separate and distinct, would not be encompassed within the first. But there can't be anything that falls outside the compass of an infinite being, for the infinite being would then be limited. The infinite has no limits. So, one substance, there can be no more. This is a somewhat oversimplified version of Spinoza's argument. He'll draw far-reaching conclusions from it, so it's important that we understand it. A modern reader will be tempted to ask here, what brought this substance about? If you ask that, though, you misunderstand the concept. Once again, if substance has its origin in anything else, anything at all, it is not substance. By definition, to exist, substance requires nothing else. Spinoza says of substance that it is its own cause. It is cause of itself. Now, this sounds strange to us. We think of cause and effect as a relationship in which the cause precedes the effect. But the kind of causation which Spinoza is talking about is not related to time. Geometry, again, provides the best example of what Spinoza has in mind. The nature of a triangle is such that its angles always total 180 degrees. Spinoza would say that the nature of the triangle causes it to be true that the angles equal 180 degrees. But there's no time relationship here. The nature of a triangle does not temporally precede the fact that its angles total 180 degrees. The relationship is one of logical implication. It follows from the nature of the triangle that its angles total 180 degrees. But this following from does not involve time. The relationship is like the relationship which holds between the premises and the conclusion of a valid argument. A conclusion follows from the premises. There is no time involved. In saying that substance is the cause of itself, Spinoza is saying that its existence follows from its own nature.
It pertains to the nature of a substance to exist.
In other words, a non-existent substance is inconceivable. In the same way that it's inconceivable that the angles of a Euclidean triangle do not equal 180 degrees, its existence follows necessarily from its own nature. Substance is singular. Substance is infinite. Substance is the cause and source of its own being, and substance is eternal as the timeless truths of mathematics are eternal. Having demonstrated these truths, Spinoza doesn't shy away from the next step. Religious thinkers, such as the great philosopher-theologian Thomas Aquinas, had traditionally used the name God to refer to the infinite and eternal first cause. Since Spinoza has shown that, in fact, substance fits this description, he concludes that the one substance is God. His identification of God with substance is a key point in his philosophy, and he uses it to draw startling conclusions in quick succession. First, since an infinite God is all-encompassing, nothing can exist outside of this God. And since things, in order to be understood rightly, must be conceived through their causes, we can understand all things by referring to God as their ultimate cause. Spinoza concludes in Proposition 15 of the Ethics.
Whatever is in God, and nothing can be or be conceived without God.
There can be no limitations to the infinite. Thus, the power of God, or substance, must be unlimited. Hence, he says,
from God's supreme power, infinitely many things, in infinitely many ways, that is to say, all things, have necessarily flowed, or always followed, by the same necessity and in the same way. As from the nature of a triangle it follows, from eternity and to eternity, that its three angles are equal to two right angles.
Finally, since all things are in God, God must be thought of as an immanent indwelling cause. The power of God is present everywhere as the indwelling cause of all things. Spinoza's concept of the relationship between God and the world is unusual. All things are in God, and the power of God is present everywhere as the indwelling cause of all things. In Spinoza's technical vocabulary, the relationship between God and the world is the relationship between substance and its modes. Substance, we remember, is that which depends on nothing else for its existence. Modes, on the other hand, are defined as things which are not capable of existing on their own, but whose existence depends on something else. In philosophy, the word mode is a technical term deriving from the Latin word modus. In ordinary Latin, it means manner or way. According to Spinoza, every individual thing in the world, every physical thing, and every action or idea is a mode. Every individual thing is a certain manner or way in which the power of God is manifest. God is active. And this activity is his continuing self-expression of the world at every moment. In Spinoza's view, the world is God's infinite and eternal power, expressing itself in infinitely many ways or modes. In a sense, then, God and nature are one. Spinoza sometimes emphasizes this by referring to the one substance as God or nature, two names for the same thing. Though Spinoza doesn't distinguish between God and nature, he does draw a distinction between the divine active power which underlies and expresses itself as things and the things that this power produces. He calls the active power natura naturans, or in English, nature naturing. He calls the things produced by that power's activity natura naturata, or nature natured. A helpful analogy for understanding this distinction, though it's only an analogy, is to think of God's activity as a dance. When we waltz, it's an activity, dancing. But this activity is also a thing, a dance. So too, God's activity, expressing himself, is nature naturing, nature's active process of self-creation. The world, viewed as a thing produced by that activity, is nature natured, the world nature has created of itself. God's indwelling, active self-expression as the world is viewed here through two different lenses. Our dance analogy can be helpful in understanding one further characteristic of Spinoza's view. Dancing is a structured, patterned activity. So too, the divine activity is structured in regular, patterned ways. Since God is infinite and timeless, these regularities of God's activity do not change. Spinoza says,
nature's laws and ordinances, whereby all things come to pass and change from one form to another, are everywhere and always the same.
When scientists such as Galileo try to discover the laws of nature, they are in fact discovering these timeless regularities of God's activity. All things and all events in nature are causally related, and are determined to exist and occur in accordance with the laws of nature. Thus, when Spinoza claims that God's nature is singular and all-encompassing, he's also saying that all things are part of a single, unified, all-inclusive causal system.
In nature, there is nothing contingent, but all things have been determined from the necessity of the divine nature to exist and produce an effect in a certain way.
Spinoza argues, too, that since natural laws follow from the infinite and eternal nature of God, or of substance, nothing in the world could possibly be different from the way it is.
Things could have been produced by God in no other way, and in no other order than they have been produced, For all things have necessarily followed from God's given nature, and have been determined by the necessity of God's nature to exist and to produce an effect in a certain way.
This is Spinoza's unusual concept of God and of the way the world flows from his infinite power. It's a difficult, abstract concept, still much debated by scholars today. Already we can begin to see why certain romantic poets, for whom nature was divine, would find a kindred spirit in Spinoza. It's also clear why scientifically minded thinkers such as Einstein would be drawn to his belief that the universe is orderly, that all things are causally related in a unified system according to the laws of nature. The view that all things are in God, and that God is the indwelling cause of all things, would later lead some 18th century readers to claim that Spinoza was a pantheist, that is, someone who believes that all things are God. In his own day, however, Spinoza was most often accused of being an atheist. Even in the Netherlands, a country known for its tolerance of religious differences, the charge of atheism was a serious one. Opposing the tenets of traditional orthodoxy was a dangerous undertaking which could lead to prison or worse, and Spinoza's views were clearly not those of the Orthodox synagogue or the Reformed Church. But were the clerics fair in labeling Spinoza an atheist? On the one hand, he claimed that without God, nothing can either be or be conceived, so it seems absurd to accuse him of atheism. On the other hand, Spinoza's God is not the God of Moses and Abraham. Spinoza's substance has little in common with the divine potentate or the heavenly father of traditional Judeo-Christian theology. Here lies much of the originality of Spinoza's position, and in this originality lies much of what offended the clergy. If Spinoza's originality is to be recognized, it's important to contrast his concept of God with more traditional views. Fortunately, he's made this easy in two ways. In his discussion in Part 1 of the Ethics, Spinoza often pauses to argue against more traditional views. Moreover, knowing Orthodox theology is based upon Scripture, he wrote an entire work justifying his interpretation of the Bible. These are the parts of Spinoza's work that we'll turn to for a deeper understanding of his conception of God.
This is the end of Part 2. Please download Part 3 to continue.